This week, we are rerunning the opera series that aired here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe in the spring. The opera about which we are speaking today corresponds to the one that is being performed tonight at the Santa Fe Opera, which is on the web at santafeopera.org. They can also be reached by phone at 505-986-5900 or toll-free at 800-280-4654. We are talking about the five operas in this season of the Santa Fe Opera, and our guest today is Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled, now in its 16th year. She speaks every night at the preview buffet at the opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be back.
We are talking today about the Santa Fe Opera's presentation of actually two shorter operas, The Impresario by Mozart and Le Rossignol by Stravinsky. Now, I've never heard of this. It's essentially a double feature.
Yes, it is, and it's unusual for the Santa Fe Opera to do this, especially with these two particular pieces, which are 128 years apart in terms of when they were created. So the way this came about, apparently, Charles Mackay, our general director, said that he had wanted to do Le Rossignol, which is the Nightingale. We'll use that interchangeably throughout the show. It's a piece by Igor Stravinsky, and Stravinsky has had an amazingly intimate connection with the Santa Fe Opera, because in the very early days when John Crosby built this opera company, Stravinsky would come here regularly. And in fact, the first American performances of Le Rossignol were conducted by the composer, by Stravinsky, at the Santa Fe Opera, which is an extraordinary coup 50 years ago. I mean, that was amazing. So he wanted to do that. And then he was thinking, well, it's only a short piece. It would only do for one part of the program. What would we pair it with? So he was thinking about it, thinking about Stravinsky. Stravinsky had spent much of his career with Diaghilev, the impresario of the Ballet Russe. And when the word impresario, he said, popped into his head, he said, that's it. I'll do Mozart's impresario alongside Le Rossignol. And you'll see why as we go through the story. They're totally opposite pieces. One is straight comedy, and the other is a very ethereal piece, the Stravinsky, of poetic fantasy. They're very different. But the same cast, the cast who sing the comic opera, will transform in the intermission and be cast in the second opera.
Nice.
That's already amazing. I mean, this is going to be very interesting. The bottom line message, moral, if you like, which opera always seems to have at the end, is that art is healing. Art makes you humble. In the first piece we have, it's about dueling prima donnas, one trying to outsing the other, and they come to the conclusion it's really art that matters, not us. And then in the Rossignol, there's a similar message, but from a very different place. So maybe we should start with the Rossignol. With the Impresario, which is the first piece.
Let me just ask you before we do that, is it normal? I mean, are there very many short operas? I mean, I was thinking of it in terms of film. I saw the Oscar-nominated short films earlier this year, and short films are such an incredible genre, but nobody ever sees them. I mean, it's very rare that you go out and see a half-an-hour film because it has to be paired with something else, usually at a film festival or whatever. What about short operas?
Yeah, well, there's the classic Cavan Pag. I mean, Cavalleria Rusticana is always paired with I Pagliacci because they're both one-act operas. They were both actually composed by Leoncavallo and Mascagni, who were contemporaries, actually friends. So that balance was pretty good. It depends on the piece. There's also Richard Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos, which we've done here, in which the first act is all about the backstage preparations for the Greek story. And you see all the nonsense that goes on backstage, the last minute changes, the composer who's tearing his hair out because his music is being decimated. And then the second act is almost like another opera. It's the Greek story of Ariadne auf Naxos. But we've met those characters before. The difference is that opera, the whole thing, is composed by one one composer by Richard Strauss. Okay. So this is something a little different and I think very innovative. I think people in the business are going to love it. I think impresarios are going to fall over themselves because it starts with the impresario who is having a terrible time with his leading ladies who will not agree to anything, who both want exorbitant fees and are totally unrealistic and unmanageable, and he's miserable.
Now, this is the Mozart.
This is the Mozart. But then this same character becomes the emperor, the leading character who finds healing in the second opera. So it's a very interesting connect. So let's talk about them. You'll get a better idea, perhaps, when we talk about specifics. The impresario is actually Der Schauspieldirektor in German. It was written in German. It was commissioned by the emperor, who was supported Mozart, in 1786. He was going to have a party at the Schönbrunn Palace in the Orangery, the fabulous Orangery, where one side is all glass, there's orange trees. It's a very beautiful place if anyone's ever been there. But in February, it would be pretty bleak. The people who were invited, the nobility, the aristocracy who came, were actually quite happy to go because this Orangery had underfloor heating, which was way before its time. But the purpose of the party, Joseph's plan was to have a very long table in the Orangery, and then on either end of the table, there'd be a little stage for the entertainment at the end of the evening. On one stage, there would be an opera buffa by Salieri, who was the court composer, and that's in the Italian style, which is the preferred style of the court. And then at the other end, the other little stage, there'd be a little piece by Mozart, who these were the emperor's two favorite composers. Mozart had to compose something in the style of a Singspiel in German. This was more the language of the people, not so accepted at court. So this was what happened, and everybody gossiped. They loved this. They knew the players, the singers, and who was going to win. The consensus was that Salieri actually won, in quotes, that night, because he did go to the trouble of writing a whole piece. Whereas Mozart was really pushed. He had something like, he was right up to the deadline for the Marriage of Figaro, which wasn't finished, and he suddenly had to write, drop everything and write this piece for the emperor. So he came up with five little pieces. They're fairly short, and then put the whole thing together. So with this piece now, as time has gone on, the beginning is like a play. It's set in our production here in what rather looks like a ballet studio of the time of Diaghilev and of Degas. If you think of Degas' paintings and the girls in the ballet dresses, it's right. a bare rehearsal room with a piano ready for if you need to sing or dancers are going to dance, and the impresario is there to audition people. So the actors and actors come in and they're all trying to impress as to how they are going to be so great. And the whole first section then is dialogue. It's drama. It's comedy, not drama. And it's in English, of course, because there's no point in doing comedy in German. No one's going to get it. And what was funny in 1786 would have been so dated today. So we have an entirely new script for that.
And it has been rewritten for this production?
Absolutely rewritten for this production. Up to the point of the five pieces that Mozart wrote, okay? So the first piece is the two prima donnas sing their pieces. And one is trying to outdo the other. And then rather than play you one of those, I'm going to take a little artistic license myself here because in those days, because the piece was short, the prima donnas would then choose other arias of Mozart to augment their performances. And today this is still true. The singers with the conductors will choose other Mozart arias to show off their voices. So I've chosen one that could well have been chosen, an aria by René Fleming that people will enjoy. And it really gives a sense of this competitiveness between singers. She's going to show off the very best that she can do. This is sung by René Fleming, who we won't have here this summer, but it'll give you a sense of how this goes. It's Il Sogno di Scipio, which is the dream of Scipio. Let's hear that first. It'll give you a sense of the competitiveness between these sopranos. Thank you. So the whole thing then becomes this battle of the divas, the dueling prima donnas. I can anything you can sing, I can sing higher. Absolutely applies here.
Exactly.
And this might be an aria. It's a Mozart aria that could be chosen to be included in the piece. So the impresario is sort of tearing his hair out. What do I do about this? And the tenor of all people then steps in a trio to try to placate the ladies and says, you know, it's really not about you and your ego and how great you are. It's about art. We're all serving art. And they actually back down a little bit and they agree that art is what it's all about. And that's sort of what this whole little piece is about. That's about it. They resolve that at the end. So let's hear a little of that trio from Mozart's The Impresario. So that is the very slight, beautiful impresario by Mozart that will open the double bill evening.
Now, what we just heard was sung in German. That's right.
Yeah, the whole first section of the dialogue is in English mm-hmm. in this opera.
But the singing is in German?
The dialogue is in English so that we will understand it, whereas Le Rossignol is sung in Russian. So already it makes that incredible shift from comedy, just by the mere fact of the language, to the sound of the Russian. And I'll play you a couple of Russian tracks so you get a sense of what that sound is. It gives it a very exotic feel.
Is there such thing as Russian comedy?
I don't know.
Sounds like an oxymoron.
Yes,
think of it.
It does. There's certainly no comedy in this. There is. There's humor. It depends how you define comedy. There's humor often, yes, and a lot of subtlety and a lot of satire in Russian literature and opera, of course, especially Pushkin. I mean, Pushkin, he might be writing about the romantic hero, but he's always tongue-in-cheek when he does it, so it's funny. So in this, not so much comedy with Igor Stravinsky. So Igor Stravinsky wrote this piece sort of in two parts, not unlike the Beethoven, the Fidelio. It happened in two parts because he started writing it as a young composer. He wrote the first act and was quite happy about it. And then he had to lay it aside because Diaghilev had discovered Igor Stravinsky and enticed him to Paris, where he lived and where it really became his home. And he went on to compose the ballet music for The Firebird, the Petrushka, and the notorious Rite of Spring, which had people pouring out into the streets with amazement at what he had done. So his music style changed dramatically from the time he wrote the first act of Le Rossignol, a first scene, it's really in three short scenes, to the time then he came back to it when he needed to come back to it to complete it. And people asked him about this. He said, well, you know, you're not writing the same music. He said, actually, it's all right, because the first act scene is a very ethereal, poetic piece. And the second two is more of a sort of a farcical scene with the crazy court of a Chinese emperor. So that's sort of the backstory of how it came to be composed. As time went on, Diaghilev really wanted to do this as a ballet. And it was one of the great ballets of the Ballet Russe called The Dream of the Nightingale, to the same score.
Now, you, Desiree, spent part of your life and career as a dancer, mm-hmm. dancing with opera. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in the opera here in Santa Fe, we have dancers. Do we have dancers in the Rossignol, the
Absolutely. Nightingale? In fact, these were their actor acrobats, dancers, who will make the magical beings, they're being called, because they will make the transition through the intermission. In fact, at this opera, I would probably stay in my seat during the intermission because it's going to transform from the studio where the auditions happen into this fantasy land of a Chinese emperor long ago. And these actor dancers will perform. There'll be wonderful choreography. In fact, that's one strength, I think, of the Santa Fe Opera. They use dance a lot, much more than other companies do. And over the years, dance, if you're going to cut anything in an opera, which is typically always too long, the first thing to cut is the ballet. It's an easy cut, and that happens. Not so much here. And if you think back to Oscar last year with that extraordinary New Zealand dancer who performed the role of Bosie in Oscar. That was a key role, and he did nothing but dance. I mean, he didn't need to sing. His body spoke for him. So here we will have dancers. It'll be a very visual piece. Stravinsky said, this is a piece that needs to be seen. As Wagner called it, a Gesamtkunstwerke. It's a total work of art. It's about costumes, about scenery, about acting, about fantasy, as well as about music. And dance, of course, is a major feature because he was now in love with dance, and here we have this piece. So, yes, there will be dance in this. But it's a complete shift when you get into this. It starts out very peacefully. We're in a sort of an unreal fantasy world, and there's a fisherman in his little boat, and he's singing an aria, wondering when the beautiful nightingale will sing. Let's hear that piece first, the aria of the fisherman from Le Rossignol.
And so this is music from Le Rossignol, the Nightingale. Mm-hmm. And I remember that fairy tale
of Hans Christian Andersen
from when I was a little kid.
Yes, that's
it's a beautiful
it's
tale.
It's exactly where everybody should go read that story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's exactly what this opera is based on very closely. In fact, Stravinsky said he loved going to Denmark because he could go to the land of Hans Christian Andersen and would love to be able to read the story in Danish because Hans Christian Andersen had a message, too. There was a point he was trying to get across. And in here, it's about music. It's about music conquering all, even death in this particular case. It's sort of the story of Orpheus, too, where the nightingale becomes the character that saves the emperor in this case. But before we get to that, we should probably talk about the nightingale, who is Le Rossignol. She comes out and she sings in this first scene. And the cut that I have to play for you is quite lovely. It's by Nathalie Desaye, who's the great soprano who's been here a number of times, who sang our Traviata
Indeed.
That you liked. Yeah. She sings the aria of the nightingale in this first scene.
So the great Natalie Dessay, what a great choice for a nightingale.
Yeah, she's absolutely perfect. And in fact, there's a wonderful DVD out there. It's a sort of an extreme avant-garde piece of art with amazing graphics. It's a short piece that I encourage people to get before they go and see the opera. What they do on that film is something can only be done on film. You wouldn't do it on stage. But it's the instruments, for instance, suddenly are caricatured, and they come in the clarinets and the plates fall. Strange things happen, but she is the uniting force, as the Nightingale is in the piece. So she sung her aria, and then suddenly the courtiers arrive. These are the courtiers of the Chinese emperor. He has heard about this famous nightingale in his kingdom, and he wants to know what she's all about.
Now, in the fable, the nightingale is an actual bird.
That's right. This is a real bird. This is a little gray, simple, plain bird who only sings pre-dawn, and that's why the fisherman waits for her, and she's happy in her forest. So the courtiers come, and the cook hears the song and invites the nightingale to come to the palace, and she says, well, I don't do palaces. I'm much happier.
I'm free.
And free, and I want to stay in the forest. But she says, if it would please the emperor, I'll come. So this is then the end of the first scene, and this lovely ethereal music that we've heard, very gentle, very meditative, ends at this point, and we are transported to the Chinese emperor's place.
And this is partly because
of Stravinsky.
You have Stravinsky, who wrote the first part when he was young, and
right.
The second part's when he was
older. Right, a few years. Well, not, it was only a few years between them, but enough. His style had changed. And you'll hear that. You'll hear it even in this next cut. Arrives at the court, and everything is prepared. Little bells are attached to flowers. And there's some very beautiful touches that are in the Hans Christian Andersen tale, which everyone should read. So that everything is prepared for the nightingale to sing. And she sings her song, and everybody succumbs to the beauty of her voice. Tears pour down the cheeks of the emperor. He's so happy, and he offers her anything she wants. He offers her the golden slipper he has around his neck, a little ornament, and she says no, she wants nothing. His tears are enough reward, and that she will go back to the forest. And he says, no, you can't go back to the forest. I need you to stay here. And when he commands, people have to do as they're told. So, but she doesn't want to do this. And at that point, we hear the Japanese envoys arrive. This is all done in fantastic costumes, really off the charts, which this opera company does so well. They arrive, and they have brought, as a gift to the emperor, a mechanical bird. So they open up this box, and the mechanical bird sings, and the emperor is enthralled. He thinks this is the greatest thing he has ever heard, because this bird will sing on demand, as the other nightingale will not.
So the mechanical bird is another nightingale.
Another nightingale, yes.
Mechanical nightingale.
Yeah. So he has this one sing, and then he says, well, where's my nightingale? And she has gone back to the forest, and he's furious. He says, she's banished from court. May she never appear here again. And the mechanical nightingale is installed by his bedside, so he will sing for him at will, which is straight fairy tale telling. Hans Christian Andersen, this sort of rather pompous autocratic emperor who thinks everyone, including art, should succumb to what he says. And that's about to turn around. But before we get to that, let's play a little piece from this of the courtiers when they come to the forest to find the nightingale to bring her to the court. These are the courtiers from Le Rossignol. And those are the courtiers from the Le Rossignol, the Nightingale.
We are talking to Desiree Mays about the double, I call it the double feature, the double bill at the Santa Fe Opera this summer, the Impresario by Mozart and Le Rossignol by Stravinsky. Now, we have gotten through, I guess, what, two-thirds of the...
That's right. There are three little scenes.
Three scenes.
Yes.
Okay.
And in the second scene, the emperor's in his court, and he has his mechanical nightingale by his side, and the little nightingale has fled. By the third scene, some time later, the emperor is now dying. He's in his bed, and his courtiers believe this is his last night, and he's calling out for help. He calls to his musicians. He calls to his mechanical bird, whose wind-up mechanism doesn't work anymore. So this bird is of no use to him whatsoever. So he goes into this sort of dazed state. And before him, this is a great scene for the dancers, appear his misdeeds under the baton, as it were, of the figure of death. Death appears and all of the misdeeds pass. You know that moment before death, they say, where all your good and bad deeds flash before you.
So this is everything, what's happening here. Everything he's ever done is a bad ruler.
I mean, yes, exactly. We don't say if the good isn't neglected in this, but he's terrified, and death is about to move in and take him away when the little bird, the real nightingale, comes from the forest and appears on the windowsill and sings. And death pauses, and death says to the nightingale, "You sing so beautifully. Please sing some more for me." And the nightingale says, "I will sing for you if you return the symbols to the king, his crown, his scepter, his emblem." And as she sings, death returns all these emblems to the emperor and then leaves. So music has the power to conquer death. That's what Stravinsky's saying here.
It seems like there's also a nature versus technology theme. The mechanical nightingale is broken, and the healing power and the power of beauty and life itself endures forever.
Exactly. That's the message, I suppose, of the piece. That's very, very beautifully stated. The emperor learns humility and great gratitude to the little bird. He still says, "Please, will you stay with me?" And she says, "No, I have to go back to the forest." And he said, "That's fine. When you want to come and sing for me, I'll accept that." But he's learned something. He's learned about the beauty of music, of song, of art, the value of art, rather as the singers in the first piece learned, but from a very different point of view. They both come to the same conclusion in the end.
And humility.
Humility, of course, yes. So when the courtiers come in the morning expecting to find him dead, there he is, bright and cheerful, wishing them a good morning, and the nightingale has gone. But she, the plain little unobtrusive nightingale, as the director said, he's dressing her in just black, a la Edith Piaf. So she's just the little bird, the little voice, whereas the mechanical bird will be dressed in feathers and sequins and to show the artifice, too. It's about art and artifice and how you need to differentiate, not be taken in by one at the expense of the other, and how the artist deals with this, and that whole theme then of confronting death itself and winning, music wins, is quite beautiful.
So there's actually, in terms of opera singers on stage, there are two nightingales, the real one and the mechanical one.
Yes, yes, that's right. The mechanical one, who is sort of boxed in a jewel box, and the other one who is just a symbol. I mean, if you look at pictures, Google nightingale, it's the simplest, plainest little bird you've ever seen until it opens its beak, and then tears can pour down. As you heard of Natalie Desay, that's what's required of this singer, to be able to make it so beautiful that it can bring you to tears. So it's a sweet tale, and it's a total contrast to the opening piece. And for the performers, great fun. If you take the role of the impresario, who will be sung by the great Anthony Michaels Moore, baritone, who is British, who talked about this, and he says, "Well, you know, we know what these impresarios go through," and Charles McKay, I think, identified with that too. But then he becomes, in the break, the emperor who is healed by the very art form he's having such problems with. There's a sort of a poetry to that. I think that's nice. The two, the prima donnas, the two fighting ladies, become the Nightingale one. And this is actually Erin Morley, who has been here a number of times. She becomes the Nightingale, and the other one sings the other soprano roles, the role of the cook. And that actually is Brenda Ray, who sang our Violetta in Traviata.
Oh, okay.
So they're great sopranos who are singing in both of these pieces. One of the most outrageous women in the first piece, an actress called Meredith Arriday is her real name. She's a comedian in that. She becomes the image of death in the final piece. So for the performers, it's a very thrilling piece to play because you get to play two very, very different characters. And the whole transition is made possible by these magical beings who are actor dancers. I love this evening. It's a wonderful pairing. It's a first for the Santa Fe Opera, and I think a very successful.
The Impresario by Mozart and Le Rossignol by Stravinsky. One thing that I think is interesting and important to talk about, I mean, we talk endlessly about the singers, mm-hmm. but there is a whole orchestra down in the pit mm-hmm. made up of virtuoso, incredible, amazing players who come from all over the country
Absolutely.
To play for the Santa Fe Opera as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the musicians love coming here. It works well with their schedules. If they belong to the big symphonies, typically they're not working in the summers, so they can come here. Many of them have fallen in love with Santa Fe and have bought homes here, so you know summer is home for them. There is a rigorous audition process that the conductor conducts to maintain the standard of this orchestra, because it's a very high standard. And they have to work under the baton of five different conductors, which is a real challenge. And most musicians are not exactly happy with that when they get two or three a day, because
yeah.
the day is split into three lots. There's a morning, afternoon, and evening, of which they can only do two. These are unionized, of course. Otherwise, they'd be playing 16-hour days, and that's not appropriate. So there's a rehearsal period performance, and that all has to be logistically worked out. The mathematical equations that must go on to work out how these rehearsals are going to work with a symphony, with dancers, with singers, with production, for five times five is sort of staggering. And I must say they have it down. Then there's the limitations of our theater, where you can't move scenery on and off easily. And then you have to fit in costume fittings and makeup, hair wig fittings. All of this has to be done in a fairly short space of time.
And sunsets and windstorms and thunder
yes,
and rain.
Yes, in spite of the weather, exactly.
Because we're it's not outdoors, but it's open to the elements.
Yeah, yeah. And with the orchestra, that is the first time I came here in the early 90s. You know, I saw the orchestra playing away there in the pit, and then there was a rainstorm. And rain doesn't come down straight, Mary Shaw. It always comes on an angle,
exactly.
right? Exactly. So it's coming on an angle into the pit, and then to my utter amazement, all of the strings, all of the musicians at the front, upped in with their instruments and moved backstage under the stage so that their instruments would be dry and they could continue playing. I mean, that's phenomenal. My sister is a musician. She couldn't believe that. She said, in Ireland, that union would never allow that. But that's the way it works. I mean, people rise to the occasion in a way that's extraordinary here.
Now, there's a conductor that conducts the orchestra and five different conductors for five different operas.
Right,
and I've actually heard musicians talking about which conductors they like the most and which ones are the most difficult to work with
and all that.
But in addition to that, there's also the director, mm. who's more like the theatrical director. How do they interact? Do they ever have conflicts of interest? Are their realms completely separate?
They can't be separate. You know, it's all about one performance, Mary Shaw. And when it comes down to it, the person holding the entire thing together is the conductor in performance. He is the one standing in front of the musicians and watching what's going on stage. Remember, the musicians can't see the stage. They're totally led by the conductor. He is the medium through which the whole thing happens both ways, from the musicians to the singers and back again. In terms of tempi, all these things, it's like walking a tightrope for the few hours of the performance. Traditionally, the conductor played a bigger role. I mean, when Mozart wrote these operas, the contract stated that he would conduct personally the first few performances. Sometimes there was no conductor. The first violin would conduct with his bow, you know, from sitting in the orchestra. Though these were small Baroque chamber orchestras, they didn't have so many players. With a full symphony, there has to be a conductor holding the whole thing together, as they do brilliantly. But in the past, the conductor has really had the upper hand. Perhaps he is the one everyone would refer to. That has changed somewhat over the years as opera has become more of a theatrical event, and directors who in the beginning weren't even mentioned, their names were not even on the bills. I mean, who put the thing together? Now it's the director who is the key person. But in the early stages, say 2 years before a production starts coming together, when they are contracted, they will typically meet together, the director, the scenic team, that's the costumes, sets, design. The design team comes together and will work with the conductor. As time gets closer, they will collaborate, one hopes. It doesn't always work very well. Some directors cannot read music, which is an appalling admission. Others know the music better than the conductor, so you have all of these computations going on. And then when they get to rehearsal time, the director works entirely separately with the performers, with a pianist. There's no way they can afford. I mean, time is money with an orchestra. With a big orchestra, they have to be paid. And if a rehearsal is to run 3 hours and it goes 3 hours, 5 minutes, that's really costly for the company. So they rehearse separately. The conductor works with his musicians. Typically, we have this lovely Styron Hall where he can work with the orchestra, and the director works with the performers. And then they come together for an astonishingly short time. There's, first of all, what's called a piano dress, where everybody's in costume and they work through their parts and their moves with a piano. And then there are only two dress rehearsals, in which time everything has to come together.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, and at least one of them is open to the public, and we buy tickets for the dress rehearsals.
Yes, these are now open. But again, I think people must realize that these are still rehearsals.
Yeah.
There are what are called notes after these rehearsals, where all the production people stay and go over changes. I mean, cuts are made at this point, which is late in the scene. Whole crowds of people, of chorus members, and extras. You know, 100 people can be moved across that stage. That's not easy to do, and it has to be done in time with the music so the whole thing fits. It's nothing short of miraculous how these things come together. So sometimes you'll see a dress rehearsal and you think, this doesn't look like it's anywhere near ready to go on, and then the magic happens and somehow it falls into place. But there's only two final dress rehearsals, at which point everyone comes together and then the director leaves. So if the director has had the main say up to that point while collaborating with the conductor, and the conductor's usually at the piano rehearsals, he'll be there going through tempi, working with the pianist, but not musicians. Once the director leaves, typically straight after opening night, then it's up to the conductor to keep the show on the road.
When you say leaves, do they sit in the audience and watch? Or what
do you mean? The director will stay, yeah, often. Well, they'll stay for the first performance, take their bow, and then typically they're on a plane to do it somewhere else in another theater. They are gone.
Yeah.
And then the piece settles in, and sometimes you see changes. Things that were not working are really perfect on the opening night sort of settle in as the evening goes on and as the run goes on. Some of our performances only have two or three shots. I mean, Dr. Sun Yat-sen only has a few performances because
right.
with a new opera, an opera company cannot afford to take the risk of a new opera and having a house that's not full. This house here has been extraordinary. It's an amazing theater, the Santa Fe Opera. I don't know if locally we really appreciate that. I had no idea before I came here how important in the world of opera the Santa Fe Opera is. First of all, they are fiscally sound. They keep their head above water and stay in the black. That's not unheard of, but rare in this business because
yeah.
it's very expensive.
Well, there was there's talk of how these metropolitan live simulcast operas have been actually hurting small opera
yeah.
companies in smaller cities because everybody just goes to the Met screening thing.
Yes, that has been a real catch-22 because on one hand, Peter Gelb, who's the director of the Met, thought, well, let's open opera up to the entire world and we'll screen our onstage productions and show it to the world, which is what they're doing. The numbers are staggering in the
yeah.
number of countries that we all sit in a theater watching it live at different times of the day, depending on where we live. For instance, we see 11 o'clock here in Santa Fe as 1 o'clock at the Met when it actually happens. That is amazing. And you get a sense of the opera in a way you would never get in the house because you're close. It's also a real challenge for singers who used not, you know, they'd make great gestures to reach the back of a 4,000-seat house. They don't have to do that now. Well, they have to find that balance between how do you act for a vast theater and for film. Yeah. That's a real challenge. So my point of view on this, and it's I think it's very important, I see the screenings as a branch to the opera tree. It's not the main trunk. It's not the real thing. I mean, that branch goes off, and it is fantastic. It gets you into the piece, but it should whet your appetite to go and see a real performance. Now, one time,
like the Santa Fe Opera.
Yeah, exactly.
Summer.
Well, I mean, one time this really came home was at the end of Werther, the incredible Werther that with Massenet and with Jonas Kaufmann, that everybody, the death scene. I mean, the thing is amazing. Everybody's built up to this point of climax. And you know what happened with the HD? They lost the feed. I mean, it went blank in the middle, the final aria, the final death aria. And in talking to people, I was in New York at the time. In New York, they lost both the vision and the sound. Other places, they just lost sound. So you had the image but no singing, and then vice versa, whatever happened. We were very fortunate here in Santa Fe because at the point where they lost it, we just had a glitch. There was a moment where the screen went blank and the sound went off and the entire audience groaned and it came back. We were lucky. Now, if you were in the real theater, you'd have got the real thing. So I always encourage people, go. I mean, this is a great way to be introduced and to see it as an addendum, but not instead of the real thing. It's always about the real thing, especially art.
Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for inviting me.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654, and the local number is 505-986-5900. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org, and we're on Twitter at radiocafemc. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by the KSFR news team, and after that, jazz.